Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My four guests this morning are great friends and have lived lives steeped in music. They came of age in the 60s and early 70s when there was a renaissance and transformation of Irish trad music as it engaged with folk and rock. At different times, in different combinations, they've played with each other. Some played in Planxty, others in the Bothy Band, and their musical lives continue to interweave. It is hard to overestimate the contribution that they have made individually to Irish music. And they're now playing together as a band called L.A. APD with their next gig here in Dublin in Vicar Street next Sunday, December the 16th. So, LAPD, you're very welcome. It's Liam O'Flynn, Andy Irvine, Paddy Dlacken and Donal Lunny. You're all really welcome.
Thanks, Miriam.
Thank you.
Take it away with a bit of music. The great thing is you're going to play live for us this morning. So what are you going to start off with?
We're going to play a reel called O'Keefe's Plough. Okay. Named after a great fiddle player from Kerry, a man named Padraig O'Keefe.
And of course, Liam, you're in the Illan Pipes. Yes. Paddy, tell people what you're playing.
I'm on the fiddle.
Andy?
Mandola.
Donal?
The bouzouki.
Okay, over you go and take it away. That was fantastic. Come back over here, the four of you. Do you like playing together? You must love playing together.
Yeah, always an enjoyable experience. Yeah.
Where did you all meet each other? For instance, Donal Lunny, Andy Irvine, where did you both meet first?
In a previous century, I was a student in the College of Art. I'd heard about Andy and I was in complete awe of him because he played several instruments. I was still just playing guitar at that time. I really wanted to meet you. And one afternoon you arrived at the house in which I was staying, and I answered the door, and you were standing there festooned with instruments, a vision. You said, are there any flats to let in here? And I said, well, you can sleep on my floor. I really wanted you to come in, but you went away again.
Did I not come in? Because I'd read about, I was looking for a flat or a room or something, and I'd found that address in the evening press or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And there you were. But I never even came in.
Nah.
So when did you meet?
So a bit later on, I can't remember when we first started playing, but we did meet up soon after
that.
Well,
I can remember that.
Can you?
Yes. Oh, great.
Andy has a memory.
Well, Sean McRaymon, rest his soul, was he the chairman or something of the Irish Soviet Friendship Society. And they were having their annual get-together. Sean asked us, I don't know whether it was individually or together, would we play at, just do a short set at the thing? Right. Where was it held? Yeah. Can you remember that?
Aylesbury Road or somewhere like that, was it?
Was it?
Yeah, one of those big...
But we had about 5 minutes to rehearse, and we rehearsed three numbers or something like that. And I remember being gobsmacked by the speed at which Donal... latched on to what I was doing, and we got on the stage, and we were wonderful, and the audience gave us a huge round of applause. Well, I don't know if they did or not, but
yes, they did.
They did.
And you, Liam, as an Illan Pipe player, when did you meet these three guys?
When did I meet these three? I think I met Donal in Prosperous, probably originally. Yep. Prosperous, a small village in County Kildare. And it was sort of like a little oasis of traditional music. There was a family there called the Rin family who are still there. And there was Davok Rin and Andy Rin, Bridget Rin. And they were really into the music. And I reckon it was their interest and stuff that, you know, started that whole business of the Wednesday session in Prosperous. But that's where I would have met Donal. I would have met, I think, in one of the folk clubs, maybe the tradition club, which was terrific. Another Wednesday night. Business.
In Slattery's.
Yeah, in Slattery's in Capel Street, yeah.
Paddy?
Probably out in the, what's the hotel?
The Hollybrook Hotel.
The Hollybrook Hotel. Can you remember, Paddy?
Well, no, it's just, you know, I don't remember the first time I met Liam, but I do remember kind of getting to know him just because it's a very small community, the traditional music community at that stage, and there used to be a session, and Liam used to come to the session with his teacher, Leo Rosen, his lesson. And that's where I first encountered Liam. First encountered Donald, I remember, in the basement of the Shelburne Hotel.
as you do.
At a Planxty gig. I remember it well. Yeah. That was, and I think I first met Andy, probably Slattery's.
Yeah, I don't remember the first time I met you.
No, I don't. There's no official. The last time I met you.
What's your name again?
But the three of you, Bar, Paddy, all ended up in Planxty. So how did that come about?
Christy, I think, drew us together by...
Christy Moore, of course.
Christy Moore. Well, we were nearly always in touch. In fact, Christy and I were sharing a bed sit before he left for England. He was away for 5 years. He had recorded an album over there. He wanted to record an album in Ireland with Irish musicians. So he contacted me and almost immediately Andy, because we were playing together at the time, and he had mustered about 9 or 10 musicians for the recording of Prosperous. Mm-hmm. And Liam was among them as well, because we all knew each other from Pat Dowling's and Prosperous.
That's right, yeah.
And we actually recorded it in Rin's house, in the basement of Rin's house.
And it was
a wonderful experience.
It really was, yeah.
When was that about?
71.
Yeah.
So that was the sort of, that sowed the seeds for Planxty, really, because Christy went away again and came back, and it was like, hey, why don't we get together, you know? Mm. So the four of us took it from there.
And you're going to
I think it was on that recording, that great sort of moment where Tourdom the Love and the Raggle Taggle Gypsy met each other.
That's right.
Two tunes.
Yeah, which was a really sort of key thing in terms of Planxty and the road that we took afterwards, you know, which was the combination of songs and traditional music.
But did you realise how big you were when you were in Planxty? Did you appreciate the success then of how big Planxty was?
I don't think any of us had any notion of the sort of impact we were making. We were listening to Gay Byrne one morning on his morning a radio program, and he was ecstatic about this new band called Planxty, and we were absolutely gobsmacked by the this happening.
Do you remember the hangar?
That
was the most amazing night I think I've ever experienced.
Tell me about that.
We were invited to open for Donovan, who had an Irish band at the time, through some contact of yours, Donal, I'm sure.
I think so, yeah.
But the first gig of the tour was in the hangar, the old hangar ballroom. In Galway.
And
we got there, and I had never seen so many microphones and lights and everything. It was quite kind of frightening. Our sound check was perfunctory, because the sound man was Donovan's brother-in-law, and he, you know... This is the support band, right? Yeah, okay, lads, that's great. Yeah, thank you. and we got on and we played our set, and about 15 minutes into it, I suddenly realized something was happening in the audience that was kind of... I thought it was a fight. I thought it was a row going on. Mm. And I looked at the lads, and they all had smiles like that, you know, from ear to ear. And I realized it couldn't be a fight. And then I thought, well, hey... We are going down ecstatically, and it was the most incredible. Remember the end of the when we got off the stage, they went berserk.
That must have been such an amazing feeling.
It was amazing, and I suppose unexpected. You
exactly,
know.
That was the point. We were not expecting anything like that.
That wasn't your first gig, was it, together?
It was the first main gig. We'd done one in Newbridge before that.
You weren't with them, Paddy, that, but you would have seen them live. What were they like?
Well, I mean, Liam was talking there about not realising the impact. Well, I would have had an idea of what the impact was, because at the time in 1972, I was in UCD at the time, and I always remembered that it was a concert you did in UCD. Tony McMahon did support that night, and it was filmed by, I think, a French film crew. And I always remember, like, the Theatre L in Belfield, and the place was absolutely stuffed. And, you know, for people of my generation, people who, say, weren't particularly into the music, reacting to the songs like the Raggle Taggle Gypsy and tunes like The Wise Maid, you know, and to see how that was accepted was absolutely phenomenal, and it had a massive impact. There's no doubt about that.
How many years at that stage did Planxty go for when it was really successful before it came to an end?
About two and a half, three years.
Three at the outside.
Not that long, given the impact.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Well, Donal wasn't. Donal, you were only in the band for about 18 months.
Yeah, 18 months to 2 years, something like that.
And why did it come to an end?
Well, I was very restless, and I wanted to try other music. You know, again, I was completely blind to, if you like, the sort of importance of Planxty at the time.
Liam and Andy, were you sad when it ended?
Well,
Liam is smiling. Why are you smiling and laughing now?
But it went on for another year and a half after he left.
Go on.
Well, can I
tell the story? Because I always remember Liam rang up everybody and said, I'd like to call a meeting. And we knew what it was about because we were run down.
Oh, but this is quite a few years later, isn't it?
Yes, it was December 75, actually, after that French tour.
Yeah. Amazing, this man.
Well, up to a point. I can't remember what happened yesterday. But so we knew what he was calling the meeting for.
I was really concerned and worried about the notion of, you know, how am I going to explain all this, But I was also aware at that stage the band wasn't really going anywhere as such. We were all exhausted, really, from travel, you know, which seems to be the way of new bands. Like, I mean, you get worked to death on the road. Mm. And I was aware as well that the rest of the people in the band were, you know, if not feeling exactly like me, they were very close to it. But yeah, I think it was the right decision at that time.
And the Bothy Band, of course, was hugely successful too. And that was you, Paddy. How did that come about?
It wasn't just me, it was six or seven other people. Well, basically what happened there was, that was about 1973. We all knew each other, a bunch of musicians around, and we were asked to play at the Gaelin 21st anniversary, and they had an exhibition going at a place called Ireland House in Stephen's Green. Mm-hmm. And we would go in there and do a lunchtime gig every day. The late Micheál O'Donnell, Trina, myself, and Matt Molloy. And we just kind of enjoyed doing what we were doing, and we enjoyed the music. And it's just kind of grew on from there. We just decided, let's do a few gigs together. And we were, at that stage, we weren't known as the Bothy Band. We were known as Cuiream, which I think is a kind of an abbreviation of concert. Mm. And then it became Seachtar. And then we christened the band, the Bothy Band, in the Isle of Maxima in Cork.
That's your memory.
That's the night we stayed in the Vienna Woods Hotel.
Do you remember that night?
Oh, tell me about that night.
The most bizarre conversation I think I ever had about neurosurgeons until about 5 o'clock. Led by Tony McMahon, of course. Yes.
That's 30 years ago. You still remember that conversation well.
I could never forget it.
Left 2 weeks, did you, before you recorded the first album?
Yeah, about two weeks to a month Why? Before. But at that stage, I realised that if it was going to be an album, it's going to entail an awful lot of work and a lot of travelling and an awful lot of, you know, commitment to try and work the album. And I really wasn't, that was a challenge to me, and I really wasn't up for that, to be honest about it. And it seemed like the honourable thing to do at that stage. Well, look, don't go there, record an album and then 2 weeks after you've recorded it to walk away from it. That would have been unfair. So I thought that was the best thing to do.
Is it because you found being in a band difficult? I mean, is the life, it's quite nomadic, I suppose.
It's hard to live a normal life when you're playing in a band, because sort of tours come up and you have to sort of drop everything off you go, you know. So it is disruptive, yeah.
But good crack.
Ah, sure, brilliant crack, yeah.
Do you ever fight?
Yeah, no problem.
But would you make up then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We'd make up with a few tunes, I suppose.
It's like a love story. But this band, LAPD, is it kind of sweet playing together?
I think it is, yeah.
During the course of last year, how many times did we play?
Six or seven
times. There isn't the same, you know, sort of pressure of the sort of new band assembling and trying to make it, you know.
Continuous lifestyle.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's like you've all made it, frankly, so now you can just enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think the fact that, you know, when Planxty reassembled, for example, back in whenever it was, 04, 05, the original band, what was that?
March 2004.
Oh, he's an encyclopedia of dates.
Living diary.
Terrific, yeah. I think one of the reasons that it was so acceptable, if you like, to people in general was the fact that it wasn't as though we'd stopped making music after, you know, Planxty had stopped.
No, you were all
But we had all carved out successful musical careers, so that the coming together was very real.
Very nice, intersection.
But isn't you going to play a piece for me now? What are you going to play for me now?
This is two jigs. The first one's called The Rambles of Kitty and the second one is called The Humours of Ennistymon.
Okay, away you go. that was great, guys. Come back over. Will you be playing them at Vicar Street next Sunday?
We will, yeah. Absolutely.
How many years have you been playing tunes like that?
Certainly, Liam and myself have been playing the first one for a terrible long time. that's certainly for sure.
Very old tune.
It's a very old tune, the Rambles of Kitty. Indeed, Liam, there was a record made in 1968 which Liam played on called The Rambles of Kitty.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Everyone, I've spoken to so many people, Liam, and I'd never met you until today, actually, and they talk about you almost godlike, this amazing Ilan player. Where did you learn and get your love for the Ilan pipes?
From my family. My mother was from County Clare, Milltown Malbay, as it happens originally. So I guess I'm related to the Clare tradition through her. My father was from County Kerry, and he played the fiddle. So, you know, I was listening to music. And friends would come in, musical friends, to my parents, and there'd be sessions. And I can clearly remember, as a little child in bed, listening to the music downstairs. I always think of it as, you know, really happy memories.
That's so
the
nice.
The only unhappy musical memories I have was when I was put to learning the piano in Naas. And I was being taught by this nun. And
It sounds painful.
It was painful because I used to get belted across the knuckles with this. She had a pencil with an extraordinary end on it. But it all ended anyway when she, one day, she got so frustrated with me, she pushed me off the piano stool. And I thought, I didn't mind it. Well, she burst into tears anyway. She was so upset.
With your playing or that she pushed you?
Well, I'd say both. But anyway, that was the end, really, of my piano playing.
And where and when did you pick up the Ilan pipes?
I was, 10, 11 years of age. And my father actually knew Leo Rowson, who was the great, great piper and an absolute master pipe maker. I'd said to my father one day, you know, I'd really love to have a set of pipes or, you know, practice pipes. So he got on to Leo Rowson, and this practice set of pipes appeared, Bag, Bellows and Chanter. Mm. And that was a fantastic just happening in my life because, And I was desperately lucky to have Leo Rowson as my first teacher because he was a great teacher, he was a great piper, and of course he was a great pipe maker. So it was ideal.
They look very difficult to play, are they?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sort of physical coordination involved in terms of pumping the bellows into the air, into the bag, reservoir of air, and then keeping the right pressure on that, and the 7 reeds in the instrument. I remember one time in England doing a concert, and I'm so sorry I don't still have the programme, because the programme said, in the programme notes, Liam O'Flynn, villain pipe. Which whether it was a mistake or whether it was by design, I don't know. But
what about your background, Donald? How did you get into music and where did you grow up?
Born in Tullamore, grew up in Newbridge from the age of 5. And in fact, I kind of had a similar experience with the piano at that age. except it wasn't a nun, it was Mrs. Hangelide, who's an Estonian woman, very, very nice woman from down the road. But I do still think that just that 6 months or whatever it was that I was learning the piano, that sowed the seeds of my music.
Really?
Yeah, I suppose taking in what the piano was, you know, the scales and the notes, semitones, the whole thing. It's laid out, it's very, very logical. I think it still stands to me, you know. And then Joey O'Shea in secondary school started a rock band, and I found a kit of drums, which I bought for about 50 pence. But that was great. But I became very interested in guitar. There were 3 guitars in the band. And I became completely obsessed with the guitar after that. And so I borrowed one, and eventually my father allowed me to buy one, even though it was a bit not at a good time in my school because I was coming up to the leaving cert. I just couldn't put it down.
Never put it down.
Never, no. An important moment was, again, Andy here had a pile of instruments in the corner of his room. And I used to go and sort of root through them. There were things like Bulgarian pipes and cavals, pan pipes, all kinds of stuff. And one day I pulled out this bouzouki and I started playing it. And I was still playing it 3 hours later. And Andy said, take it, get out of here, take it home with you. So I did, and I reversed the strings on it.
Why did you reverse the strings?
Well, I'm left-handed, and I had been playing it upside down. But when I did that, I put unison strings on it, which kind of changed the nature of the instrument a bit. But Andy very kindly gave it to me.
So you only play the bouzouki really because of Andy Irvine?
This is true.
You owe a lot to him.
I sure do.
Mutual.
This is true. Yeah. It changed everything. Yeah.
And Paddy, you got a fiddle when you were 5 or 6, did you?
My 6th birthday. I was expecting something else and I was given a fiddle.
And
I was expecting a pair of football boots, to be honest with you. And this fiddle was given to me, and I was brought to my first fiddle lesson in the College of Music. Clara Green was my teacher.
Lovely name.
Very, very nice woman. And like the two lads, I just didn't take to this stuff too well. I don't know what it was. And the only good thing was the fact that my father played the fiddle, and he was playing the reels and jigs at home. That saved me because there was, you know, he would teach me a few tunes and I could make some sort of sense of it. The tedium of the scales and arpeggios and the exercises and all that, I didn't take to it very well. And then really, like the day, I suppose, kind of the tabernacle of the music was sort of opened up to me, was when I met John Doherty for the first time. I was about 9 or 10. And that was sort of that was it. You know, I mean, something just happened that day when, like, and it was because of the fact that he asked me to play for him. And he said, play me a tune. And he said to me, he said, that's very good. He said, you should stay playing the fiddle. Mm. And I did. But that was it, you know. So, anyway, but I was very fortunate that the traditional music was running parallel to the classical thing.
Yeah, you know, in your own family.
Yes, my own family, absolutely.
And Andy, you?
I was born in London. My mother was a musical comedy actress. My father was had played the saxophone. I got a guitar for my 13th birthday. And I don't know what kind of fiddle you got. And you obviously got a good set of practice pipes. I got a brown guitar that must have cost about £4, I think. And my sister had married a musician, and he knew Julian Bream. So I went. I was brought by my mother to talk to Julian Bream, and the first thing he said was, "Well, you'll have to get a new guitar." And then he said, "Well, how well do you want to play?" Because we were talking about him teaching me, and I didn't know how to answer that question. So I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, would you like to play like this?" And he played this piece, which had me in floods of tears. You know, I'd never been that close to an instrument like that before. And I said, "Oh, yes, I'd love to play like that." Wow. But I never did get there. Of course, after about three years, I just figured that practicing 3 hours a day classical music was not really where I wanted to be at. And at that time, skiffle. I suddenly discovered skiffle, and hey, I can play these chords. You know, I'm playing all these bar chords, chomp, 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 which wasn't the right thing at all. But so that's how I started.
Just listening to Andy there talking about when he first heard Julian Bream play and the emotional impact it had. I remember the first time I heard an orchestra play. My parents brought me to, I think it was a Gilbert and Sullivan opera in the Gaiety Theatre. And at the very beginning, the national anthem was played and the orchestra struck up, and I actually almost fainted with it. I'd never heard this kind of sound before. I feel very fortunate that, you know, down the road I've actually, you know, through the music of Sean Davey and so on, made music, brought the Eland pipes, I suppose, into that
the Brendan
world,
Voyage.
The Brendan Voyage and so on, yeah.
But look, you're going to play another piece for me now?
We're going to play a song called My Heart's Tonight in Ireland.
Yeah, you're going to sing in it?
Which Andy wrote?
Yes, yeah. It's a song about... it's a nostalgic thing.
Well, tell us about it. You wrote it now. What is it about?
Well, it's about the first band I was in, Sweeney's Men, and how in the summer of 1966 we went off in a red Volkswagen van and had a wonderful summer. You know, we'd no gigs, but we'd play in pubs and people would give us a bit of money or buy us a drink, or one time famously they filled up the tank of the van with petrol for us. When we got back to Dublin after the summer was over, it was a hard, cold winter, and we were all living in the same house together, starving to death, freezing to death.
and we realised we had become professional musicians.
My heart tonight is far away across the rolling sea in the sweet mill town Malbay, and it's there I'd love to be.
That's a really lovely song. Gorgeous stand in the pipes here.
Yes, and I remember when I heard this song first, Andy makes mention of the great Clare Piper, Willie Clancy. And it occurred to me, I think Willie would have been really, really proud and really pleased.
It's so nice to hear that.
Yeah, He certainly would.
Because, you know, I always wanted to be on kind of first name terms with Willie Clancy. And he'd say, "Ah, Andy, how are you?" But the nearest I got to that was he said, "You were here before."
You're kind of incredibly lucky, though, I think, all of you who work permanently in music, that it's such a beautiful career to work in. Mm, do you feel lucky, Donald?
I certainly do, yeah. I think there's a privilege in it. It's lovely to enjoy what I'm doing so much, and to be still able to do that at this time in my life, I feel lucky.
I often think of it as like living the dream as far back nearly as I can remember. I love the idea of playing music for other people, performing, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it's a feature of traditional music sessions that an individual is asked to, we'll have, a tune from so-and-so or a song from so-and-so.
Mm, mm.
But, it is really living the dream, if you can.
I think, well, being a musician, there's a certain insecurity to it as well, you know.
Sure.
Personally, I've kind of bumped along the bottom financially from time to time, but managed to keep afloat.
And if you hadn't done music in your lives, what do you think your lives would be like?
I think I might have been a national hunt jockey.
That's good.
No, there were two passions in my life
from
the beginning. One was music and the other was horses.
That's so interesting. And do you think
mad combination.
Yeah, good though. And might you have been good enough to do it?
I've no idea. But I've always kept a huge interest in horses. And indeed, I married a very distinguished horsewoman.
Okay.
And very successful, yeah. So I live with music and horses 24 hours a day.
Pretty powerful. Andy was doing an imitation of you there, playing the pipes on the horse, going along.
What an album cover.
The closest I've ever... I saw it one time at in the Lorion Folk Festival. I heard these pipes in the distance, these Scottish pipes, and I couldn't figure out where the music was coming from. And the next thing, this motorbike came up the road and the fella on the pillion was playing the Scottish bagpipes.
So you
not Ireland pipes, no.
But Paddy, you didn't do it full-time in your life. You didn't. But you've no regrets about that?
No, absolutely not, because I got a chance to work in both sort of spheres, both music and my other passion, as everybody knows, the sport. I drive everybody to distraction about it. And I got a chance to work in sport here. But I started in sport and I wound up working in all the different departments and ended up back in sport as the head of the radio sports department. And I just left here 3 months ago.
Miss you, Paddy.
I had an absolutely wonderful time. I had a really wonderful time. I enjoyed the whole milieu of sport so much, it was a wonderful opportunity. But, all along the music ran parallel to it. And it was great. Like, for 5 years, I worked in the Arts Council as the traditional music officer. And the sport was a great saviour for me to get away from the intensity of all that was going on there. And the music then was sort of the saviour to get away from the intensity of the sport when it was going on. So it worked very well for me. And I really, I can't pass a television if there's something on. I have to go sit down and look at it, you know. That's just the way it is.
I think I read something that you described music as the oxygen of the emotions. It was very...
There's a phrase.
What do you mean by that?
Somebody asked me, what would the world be like without music? And I thought we'd all go nuts. And it occurred to me that music is a sort of... It's like oxygen. The word for the emotions followed that. So, that was really philosophical, wasn't it?
No, but it's true. I mean, Andy, you've been singing and playing for decades, and do you love the experience? Like, when you go out next Sunday in Vicar Street, will you enjoy that as much as you've always enjoyed doing music, or will you enjoy it even more?
I'll enjoy it to the full. I don't know whether it'll be more or whatever, but We've been rehearsing the last couple of days, and it's been ecstatic. You know, I mean, one projects oneself into the audience, and the first four or five numbers, you think, yes, this is a strong. This is going to be great. You know, and as Donald said, you know, after the first three or four numbers are really well received, you can relax and just enjoy the rest of the night. Mm. And so I am really looking forward to walking onto that stage. Indeed, I am. Yeah.
And when you're on stage, I mean, obviously, if I'm in the audience, I just see you playing, but you have lots of, like, your own crack together. Do you have looks at each other, like, you know?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like what?
Or you can see a glance across the stage.
There's a whole other layer of activity going on. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the music is it's a kind of a journey, you know. It's kind of like you're traveling the tune or the song or whatever.
There's a sort of a shared anticipation, in the songs and in the tunes, that you know that are sort of significant parts coming up, and you will look at each other, at different times when that happens. Yeah,
you've played together so much years. Do you know each other really well?
I'd say pretty well. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, man, though, do you talk about your emotions and things?
No comment.
Patty's just smiling. Do you have deep conversations or not? Or do you just have fun?
No, there would be moments when, you know, something can come up and you can have a pretty straightforward conversation about it, and you don't feel inhibited, you know, and I think that's the most important thing, you know, and to feel comfortable, you know, that you can say something without it becoming, you know, interpreted in a different sort of way. You know, basically you're talking about being honest, you know, and that's really what it's about, I think, you know.
Yeah, and I suppose you don't want to lay anything heavy on the other people as well, you know.
But if you're worried about something, would you confide in each other or not?
In my case, probably not.
But what kind of thing would you be talking
about? To know if someone close to you was ill or...
You would share that, absolutely. Yeah. You know,
I think so, yeah. I mean,
because that affects, you know, what you're going to do on the stage. I mean, obviously, like, if it's affecting your form, and if your form is not good, then that's affecting everybody else around you. So therefore, like, you know, I mean, that's, I think that'd be pretty natural to share that sort of a burden in that sense. And to know that it was being accepted is even better again, you know.
It's a professional relationship, but there are friendships as well, you know, so that's it. So it's both.
Do you think music can be spiritual?
Yeah. Oh, completely.
Yes.
You know,
I mean, it's music is such a powerful language of communication, of emotional communication. It's, you know, from time to time, maybe somebody, you know, you meet somebody after a concert and they'll say, that particular tune or that particular song really, you know, had me in tears or really elated me or something. And that's, it's a huge reward, I think, for a musician to receive that,
And music, you can interpret it on several different levels, you know. So it can fit various states of mind, you know. Mm. You can be really happy and the music can make you higher. Or you can be very sad and the music will still, you know, come to you, whatever, you know. So.
And as we come to a close, I mean, I suppose you said earlier music can be spiritual. I'm just interested on a Sunday. Are you spiritual, Liam? Are you religious?
I'm spiritual, yeah.
Do you think you'll meet these guys?
You're asking me very hard questions now.
No, no, I'm just going to say, do you think you'll meet these guys and play with them in heaven?
I doubt it somehow or another.
You, Paddy?
I'm not sure.
Andy?
I always figure that we, as the human race, we know so little of what is available in knowledge that we really have no right to make any comment at all about this, you know.
It's like asking a fish, what's it like on dry land? But I think we'll all meet. I'd see you in 25 years' time or whatever. I mean. Yeah, I think it doesn't stop here.
That's sweet. Do you think that, Donald?
Yes, I do, yeah.
And he says it with such authority, I think I believe him.
Conviction.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. No doubt in my mind.
Why are you so sure of that?
Because of, I suppose, a number of incidents of people being revisited by people who had passed on, commonly called ghosts.
Yeah.
I mean, which could be like some kind of a time loop. Because time is a very peculiar thing. But I think that there's a continuum. And, you know.
That's a really nice way to end, actually.
We're in the chrysalis stage at the moment.
Yeah. So you'd be playing with these guys in about 25 years?
No bother.
Somewhere else.
They'll all be frogs.
But look, we're going to play, and you're going to play me one last piece of music.
It's a song written by a friend of mine called Andy Mitchell, and it's called Indiana. And it's about, I'm not sure if it was one person or two people who went to America quite early in their lives, lived there in Indiana, were content enough, but never found it was quite home. And when they got a bit older, they decided to come home again. And there's a bit of music before it called The Dream.
Beautiful. Well, go and play that. It's been a real pleasure having you today. And playing live has been a double pleasure. Liam O'Flynn, Paddy Glacken, Andy Irvine, Donal Lunny, keep playing. And I know next Sunday night, the 16th of December in Vicar Street, your band LAPD are playing. Tickets from the usual outlets. Thanks on sound today. Thanks to Andrew Kane, to my producer Eileen Heron. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, thank you very much for listening. We're going out listening to Indiana.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.